My name is John Katz. The name of the program is One Man's View of Americanism. This is an opportunity to exercise your rights and responsibilities as an American citizen. In the opening line of Charles Dickens' book, A Tale of Two Cities, he said, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." Our guest today is going to tell us about those times. He's Mr. Otto J. Scott. He wrote a marvelous book entitled Robespierre, The Voice of Virtue. And we're going to tell you today the story of the French Revolution. And ladies and gentlemen, after you get through listening to this story and comparing it with what's going on today, I think that you'll feel that the game plan was set 200 years ago. Otto, thank you for being in the studio with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's really an honor, and I'm telling you, I enjoyed this book so much, and I was very pleased to hear just before the program that it's going to come out in paperback in the next few months, and I'll be able to offer it for purchase over this radio show.
Yes.
Good. I wanted to start off right now and have you tell us not about the French Revolution for a few moments, but I'd like the mood of the country, France, in the years preceding the French Revolution, starting possibly in the time of Louis XV.
Well, Louis XV, of course, was a very famous lecher in Rouen. He had the Deer Park, which Norman Mailer wrote about, in fact, named a book after it, in which young girls from all over the realm of France were brought for his pleasure. He had inherited the throne at a time when they really had gone over the hill in terms of expenditures. The various adventures of Louis XIV had left the throne by the time Louis XV took it in a rather precarious position. And Louis XV was the man who said, "Après moi, le déluge." After me, the deluge. He knew that the country was running down in terms of its government, but the country was growing up in every other term. It was the wealthiest country, I guess, at that time in the world. It had more people than any other country in Europe. It had 25 million people. Spain had about 9 million. England had 5 million. We had 4 million. There was no Germany because it was broken up into little states. There was no Italy that was similarly broken up. Russia was on the other side of the moon. Prussia and Austria were the other two big powers, but they were much smaller than France. France was the leader of the West in terms of art, architecture, in music, in dancing, in furnishings, in painting, in poetry, in literature, in commerce and industry, in science, in everything you can think of. But the government was profligate. The government was extravagant. They spent untold millions in ridiculous efforts to no particular point.
I want to stop you right here for just a moment. With this knowledge, and most people who were learned at that time understood what France was all about, how could men like Franklin, Jefferson, and Tom Paine, how could they have the misconception that it was nothing but chaos in France prior to the Revolution, when all of these marvelous things that you were just telling us about were going on?
Well, for one thing, there was a fashion in France, a literary and intellectual fashion of denigrating the country and the culture, which began with Voltaire. Voltaire took his winnings as the lottery winner that won the national lottery and went over to London in 1715 or so. And in London at that time, there was a fashion of ridiculing religion on the top. The elite had still not gotten over Cromwell and the dissident religious groups. So they made fun of religion. They made fun in particular of Christianity. Voltaire brought that style back to Paris, and he began to write his satires, which became a tremendous hit. They became very fashionable. And then after being fashionable, they became, you might say, the mode. Everyone went that way. So there was an avalanche, a torrent of denigrations against the church, against the military, against the crown, against the clergy, against the traditions, against the whole history of France. Voltaire called the history of France a record of criminality.
I want to stop you right there. Here's our first correlation between the United States of America of today and France back then. We have people in this country that hate the United States of America. We are continually apologizing because we have more food. We're continually apologizing because we use more energy. We always get those facts thrown at us that 6% of the world's population in the United States is using 50%. We're wrong. We're not doing enough. We're not giving enough. Is there a correlation between that and what went on then?
That was the first time that a culture actually began to commit suicide since the Greeks. Now, the ancient Greeks, 5th century B.C. Athens, fell into the same pit. When the Athenian intellectuals, who called themselves sophists, or they've since been called sophists, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, and the rest, began this whole business of discussions with their pupils and with one another, attacking the idea of the gods. And the belief of the Greeks in their faith, in their religion, began to wane, began to diminish. Now, historically speaking, there's never been a civilization arise without a faith. And there has never been a civilization endure the loss of its faith. In the end, of course, the people stoned the sophists to death. We don't hear much about that. In France, they picked up the same sort of disease. You might say it was inherited in a way from the Renaissance, where the ancients were supposed to be smarter than the moderns. And by the 1780s, it was entrenched. It was entrenched. Franklin, Tom Paine, and the others that you referred to really didn't get to Paris until the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s. And that's when the disorders began to break out.
Going back to our original question then, we have, even though they have all of this prosperity, they have profligate spending.
The government was going bankrupt, but the people were getting rich. Because the tax structure was unequal, the tax structure was not really just. There were lots of things wrong with the political structure of France at the time, or let me say with the administration of it, because no government is better than the way it's applied. One of the things that the early revolutionists said, 1789, was that the overall structure was obsolete. They had the crown, they had the church, and then they had the commons. They had the crown, the nobility, and the commons. Well, that's the same structure that Great Britain has today. And Great Britain doesn't consider it obsolete. They have the crown, they have the Lords temporal and the Lords spiritual sitting in the House of Lords, and they have the commons. But the argument of the revolutionists, and they really didn't consider themselves revolutionists to begin with. They considered themselves reformers. They were liberal reformers who wanted to liberate, so to speak, the people from the rules of the ancien regime. Now, these rules had not been applied across the board. For instance, they had rules against blaspheming the church or the crown. Well, by the 1780s, those had been dead letters. They forgot about them. And there was an avalanche of literature which began to appear from the cellars and from shops and from all over. Sometimes they had a satiric legend on the upper right-hand corner saying, printed in Peking. And they ranged all the way from cartoon books to scholarly journals. And nobody has ever been able to find out who paid for all this avalanche of literature. Magazines. They called them then journals. We call them today magazines.
Now, were they giving them away to the people?
Yes.
Well, where could they possibly get the money?
Well, they didn't have advertising. And money poured in on France. France, don't forget, was the biggest country in Europe. It was the leading country. And every other country was envious of France and wanted to bring it down. Money poured in from Prussia. From Frederick the Great. Money poured in from Russia, from Catherine the Great. Money poured in from Madrid, which had always been against France and was always trying to bring it down. Money poured in from England. I mean, Pitt's gold was not a myth, it was a fact. And money poured in from inside the country, where various clubs got together and fraternities and groups. The Jacobins were only one of those clubs. The Illuminati was another club. There were more clubs than I can name. There was also, of course, the Royalist Club, which had lots of money. They all had magazines and newspapers of their own. journals, as they call them today.
Right, but you say now that they wanted to reform people. That's what they fed, or they wanted reform. That's what they fed the
masses.
They
wanted reform.
But what did they really want to reform, and for what benefit?
Well, we don't know what the original thought was, but their pattern was the Cromwellian Revolution in England, which took place in the middle of the 17th century, which was about 140 years before. Now, when Cromwell and the Puritans rose up in England, they took possession of commons, and they made commons the ruling body in the country. And commons called in King Charles I. They had a war, and they captured the king, and they put him on trial for being an enemy of the people, and they cut his head off. And that was the big original pattern for the French Revolution. But the French Revolution, of course, was 140 years later. There were more literate people in the 1780s than there had been a century before. And there were a great many of these young men who were leading the argument, you might say, were journalists and lawyers, radical lawyers who were defending the poor, so they said, radical journalists who were talking in terms of the people's will. People like Robespierre, who was a lawyer, and who was raised by, he was educated at the expense of the church, which he hated, and taught by the clergy, which he hated. These were individuals who had inherited a rich country, had no idea how it got to be rich. They just were taught from the beginning that everything that was going on was wrong.
Otto, I want to go back, and just to prove a point for my listening audience, we always hear when these revolutions start that it's always the poor that rise up. It's always the poor that are the leaders. Is that true?
Never. How could the poor rise up? The poor are too busy trying to scratch out a bowl of beans for themselves. The poor people have to go to work. They can't afford to lead revolutions. I always think of this when I see these busloads going into Washington, D.C. to demonstrate. I wonder, who rented the bus? Who was providing the box lunches? Where are they living? What hotels are they staying at? Who is buying the gasoline? Who paid for those signs? Well, it was very similar in this case. There was lots of mysterious money floating around, but the original argument and the original promise was that they would reduce the tax privileges, so to speak, the inequities of the system. Well, let me jump ahead now to Louis XVI. By 1789, two things happened. First, there was a sort of a freak weather in 1788, which hurt the crops. So there was a certain amount of privation there. It would be like one of our droughts. This wasn't enough to topple the government, because it had already gone beyond that stuff many times. But the Queen, for instance, was running a soup kitchen in Paris. And one of these newspapers came out saying, when the Queen was asked what she should do for the poor, she said, let them eat cake.
But of course she actually didn't say that, did she?
No, of course not. But that lie immediately spread throughout the country. Now, the king was told, Louis XVI, was told that the government was practically bankrupt. It spent the last of its money helping the Americans to get rid of Great Britain. Well, what happens when a government needs money? It has to raise taxes. Well, Louis XVI was smarter than McGovern or some of these other people. They didn't say, smarter than the Democrats, he didn't say, we've got to raise taxes, you've got to raise taxes. He said, we'll reform the tax structure. So they called all the General Assembly together on the 5th of May, 1789, with the idea that they would reform the tax structure. That meant that they would probably have to tax the church and tax the nobility, spread the burden out a little more easily, raise new money. They had to do this because French government bonds were no longer accepted in Amsterdam or in Holland or in Switzerland or in anywhere else.
The international bankers were, in other words.
That's right. They'd run out of credit, and nobody would lend them any more money. Well, the first thing that the commons said is that our structure is antique. We don't want to have a separate house for the nobility and another house for the commons. We want to have all commons. And the king agreed. Very easy man to get along with. So they changed the structure. They had new elections. And they reduced the power of the king to a constitutional monarchy like the King of England. And then they began to agitate against the nobility and against the clergy. They also began to agitate for a still newer constitution. They held more elections. They brought back more radicals. And then these radicals began a series of what they called inquiries. They began to inquire into the misdeeds of the past, into the misdeeds of the Ancien regime. They began to confiscate property. They confiscated all the property of the church. They confiscated the great estates and the property of the nobility, always, of course, in the name of punishing them for past crimes. And inevitably, the penalties led to the death penalty.
What about Louis XVI? We've heard so much about him that he was a profligate spender. He didn't care about the people. He was confiscating land. He was a terrible, terrible man. He was licentious, etc. Would you tell my audience about him?
No, just the opposite. He was what you'd call uxorious. He was overwhelmingly fond of his wife and didn't even have a mistress, so far as we know. He liked to tinker with clocks. He was an amiable, I would say, a little bit above average intelligence, but no more. He was versed in Latin and was sort of literary in his taste and a sort of a figurehead who operated, and we should be used to figureheads after Mr. Reagan and some of our other presidents, who operate according to their advisors. He went by his advisors, and his advisors at every step advised him to give up, to give way, to step back. Don't make an issue of it. And he was very, very much horrified by the example of the Cromwellian Revolution, where the king had fought with guns and with an army against his subjects. He felt that that was a terrible crime on the part of Charles I, and he would never turn the French army loose on the people. And because he wouldn't, they kept pushing him farther and farther down.
If what you say is true, and this was a fine man, then they had to get to him some way. They had to be able to attack something or someone in his family in order to get the masses aroused to go along with what they were doing. Tell us about Marie Antoinette.
Well, you have to... Marie Antoinette was of Austrian descent, and they accuse her, of course, of being a spy, things of that sort. But let's go back a bit. In the 80s, when this avalanche of literature appeared, it was literature of a sort that had not been seen in the West since the crucifixion. Since, well, let's say the year 300 or so. Because it was the Roman Empire at its worst. It was a combination of radical politics and dirty sex. Pornography and radical politics blended together. And everyone in the upper class, everyone in the church or in the nobility, was accused of being a pervert of some sort or another. Marie Antoinette, the queen, was accused of being a whore. The king was accused of being a cuckold. And there's a whole mass of that literature which is still in the library at Paris. And it's called, by the historians, the Inferno. The Inferno. They absolutely blasted everyone's reputation. And you know that a lie travels fast, and people are apt to believe the worst of each other. The truth, in this case, never even appeared at all. Everyone was drenched with scandal. It was almost like Washington today. Nobody gets out of Washington, D.C. today with his reputation intact. It's the graveyard of reputations. You go to Washington, and the long knives start in on you to bring you down. Well, it was like that in Paris.
What happens to the moral fiber of a nation when everybody starts attacking everyone and everybody's considered a crook or a thief or a prostitute, etc.? What does it do to our moral fiber?
Well, it means that virtue becomes unbelievable. You can't say that somebody is a good person because the belief in good people absolutely evaporates. You believe that there is no such thing as decency or virtue. They're just putting it on. And in the case of France in the 1780s, the floodgates opened up, and there was a great marked decline in religious faith because the church, you understand that in France, the king could appoint the cardinals and the bishops. They weren't appointed by the priests. You didn't have to be a priest to be a cardinal. Cardinal Richelieu, for instance, was not a priest. So the church was corrupt, although the parish priests weren't all corrupt. Some of them were self-sacrificing and good, but it was an official church and it was in bad shape. Then you had the rise of occult groups. groups that believed in astrology, groups that believed in hypnotism, groups that believed in licensed sexual behavior of all sorts. You had a great increase in prostitution. The French prostitutes became famous because they went around carrying little girls with them, and it was the little girls that they were selling. They had faggot costume balls all over the country.
And in San Francisco today.
Yes, the police would be used to protect the carriages of the wealthy and the middle class who came to mingle with these creatures in their dances. They hired whole auditoriums, they had orchestras, they had fancy dress, men in drag, women dressed as men, the whole thing. The Marquis de Sade, who was really a count, the Count de Sade, who called himself a Marquis, the Count de Sade was, you might say, almost a living representative of the period.
It's incredible. It's exactly everything you're saying is what we're seeing right here, not only in the United States, but in California, and as close as 90 miles away from us right now. Getting back. All right. When Marie Antoinette married King Louis XVI, she was a very young girl.
Yes.
Now, she probably had different ideas and her philosophy of life prior to having children, but after that, what type of a person was she? Was she against the poor? Did she say things like, give them cake, or did she feel that way?
Well, she began as a young and extravagant woman. And then she became a mother, and she became more serious as she got older. And the court was a fairly serious court. It wasn't like the court of his predecessor, the 16th. He didn't have a harem. He wasn't an extravagant man. But the reputation that was hung on them was five times filthier than the reputation of any of the predecessors. Because you understand, his predecessors would not have allowed that avalanche. And he did. He was a liberal. They were all liberals. Marie Antoinette began to play at being a milkmaid. You remember that from your history books. They began to stop wearing very fancy clothes and to dress down so they'd be more democratic. Helping the American war against Great Britain did a lot to bring in the ideas of democracy and of mutual tolerance and less elaborate manners and so forth. Almost, you didn't get to the point of saying comrade, but they were coming close to it. And that was the atmosphere in which the first stage of the revolution was enacted, reducing the king to a constitutional monarch. He had a veto. And he was, like our president, he was supposed to conduct foreign relations, could declare war or peace, which is more than our president can do, and he had the veto over the legislature.
You brought up a point right there from your book, and I'd like to refer to Robespierre, the voice of virtue here. The masses were so ignorant, and of course Isaiah stated in the Bible that my people have gone into captivity for lack of knowledge. All right? We had the masses out in the street who used that word veto as almost like a club, and I want to get into the word club a little later on in the program, but they were telling the masses that a veto meant no food.
Well, yes, these were agitators. Pardon me. The agitators. One agitator was quoted as saying, you get a loaf of bread, the king says veto, and they take it away from you.
Another thing you mentioned in your book, another thing that they've fooled the mob with. You go home to have dinner. Your wife is preparing dinner. The king says veto, therefore you don't get any dinner.
Yes, well...
And the mob believed this because they didn't have the education to even understand what the word veto meant.
Well, here we have, if President Bush decides to veto what our Congress is doing today, you'll see a similar outcry. Why should the will of one individual stand in the will of the people?
And, of course, then you get into majority and the mob rule, etc.
That's right.
Our guest is Mr. Otto Scott, and we'll be back with the French Revolution right after these messages. We're back. My name is John Katz. The name of the program is One Man's View of Americanism. And our guest today, live in the studio, is Otto J. Scott, the author of an outstanding book entitled Robespierre, The Voice of Virtue. And it will be back in paper book edition later on this year, and I'll certainly be offering it to you. Before we go on with more questions, I want to dedicate my program today to my artist, Mr. Kirk Beebe in Stockton. Now, the reason I'm dedicating this show is Kirk was born on July the 14th, which is Bastille Day. Now, I'm not going to tell you what year he was born. That wouldn't be fair. But all I want to say is, Kirk, those drawings that you made when they were actually knocking down the doors of the Bastille were terrific. You did a great job. Otto, we're back now, and what I'd like to do now is tell my listening audience about the types of individuals that were attacking their own society, their own culture, etc. A few of the names, of course, I'd like to start off with Robespierre. Would you tell us about Robespierre, Marat, Mirabeau and these type of people and put them in categories for us?
Well, Mirabeau was a noble. He was a count. But he was a count who had great difficulties with his father. And when he was a young man, his father had him imprisoned under a lettre de cachet. In those days, your family, your father, could put you in jail if you disobeyed him. He was released. He went to Prussia. And in Berlin, he became acquainted with a number of sort of semi-revolutionary groups. And Mirabeau was a very eloquent individual who came to believe that the English system was the best, that if France was governed the way England was governed, it would be, it would have no problems or relatively few. What he forgot was that the French and the English were two different types of people. Marat, on the other hand, was a physician. And he was a very strange individual. He appeared in London and operated as a physician in London and also in Paris. He was an out-and-out, total, no-holds-barred radical who apparently hated the whole human race. If he could, he would have killed everybody.
Now, question there. This is very strange, and I know it doesn't sound like it's very important, but when he was in England, he was very well-dressed and respectable.
That's right.
He kept himself clean.
He had to.
Very handsome-looking. Tell us what happened when he got into the French Revolution.
Well, then he let himself go completely. Dirty clothes, no bathes. Well, that's not quite true because he was murdered in the bath. But a man that absolutely made your flesh crawl. Some of the others were up-and-coming journalists. A playwright, for instance, who wrote a very radical play that was very popular, Figaro, in which the valet was smarter than his employer, and everybody laughed at his employer. It was a sort of a sinister version of comedies that came out in the 30s here.
What about, now there, here we're drawing correlations again. A program I've only seen 5 minutes on television, Married with Children. Mm-hmm. I talk about it all the time on here, mm-hmm. where the parents are absolute idiots mm-hmm. and the children are smarter, and they're doing that with many of the programs today on television.
Well, yes, we had this, the idea that the youth that's coming up, don't forget, we're talking about a country, in France, where schooling was excellent, and there were lots of schools, and lots of people went to school. And where there was the reason that all this literature, all this combination of porno and political literature had such effect was that it was a reading generation. It was a generation not only that did a lot of reading, they did a lot of writing. They wrote avalanches of letters to one another, and they kept diaries. So we have almost a documentary minute-by-minute versions of the revolution from the different angles of the different people involved. Now, the nobility was suffused with guilt. It felt after this avalanche of denigration that it had to make up to people for the sins of its forebears who had taken land and who had exploited the peasants and so forth and so on. So we had, and the clergy walked very humbly. When the first National Assembly was called together. General Assembly was called together. The Bishop of Paris came into the Commons with his priests following him in his robes because it was an official opening. And he came over to Robespierre to say that the church hoped to work with the reform. And Robespierre's response was, sell all the jewels and the ornaments of the church and give the money to the poor.
Incredible. There's something that happens in every country, and I think the book 1984 brought it about and made more people aware of this. They have to change history. They have to denigrate history, and then they have to change history.
Well, you can't change unless you denigrate.
Well, right, right.
You have to say that everything that you've got now is no good before you can introduce something else.
There was a gentleman that, and I'll mention his name in just a moment, who hired three people. And the three people he hired were Voltaire, Diderot, and D'Alembert. He told them to rewrite the history of the world. They did, and they called themselves, and I think this is an amazing thing, the encyclopedists.
Yes.
All right. They were hired by a man, I'd really like you to tell my audience about this man, Jean-Jacques Rousseau.
Well, Rousseau, they really were... Rousseau was their, you might say, their great genius. And it's very interesting because the book by Bloom, The Closing of the American Mind, which in many respects is a very good book, falls apart because he's a Rousseauist. He follows Jean-Jacques Rousseau to this day, 200 years later. Rousseau was the one who said people are basically good and society is responsible for all their errors. If a man is a criminal and does something terrible to people, it's because he was raised in the wrong environment. He's really innocent.
It's society's fault.
It's society's fault. He said man was born free and is everywhere in chains. Now, the fact of the matter, man is not born free. He's born helpless, at the mercy of everyone, and has to be taken care of until he reaches maturity or near maturity. So his whole upbringing is a credit to the altruism of others. But he's not free.
Did Robespierre follow the virtues of Rousseau, or did he have his own philosophy?
Well, he went to see Rousseau at one point, and he wrote about it. He was deeply moved. Rousseau, who was always talking about virtue, had a number of illegitimate children, which he carried to the nearest orphanage. He forced his mistress to place the children at the steps of the orphanage and ring the bell so the nuns would come out and take the child in and take care of it. He had no use for the church, however. None whatever.
Do you know what this reminds me of? Karl Marx traveling around talking about helping the masses. They all want to help the masses. And here he is traveling all throughout Europe in luxury with Friedrich Engels, who was extremely wealthy, and seven of his nine children starved to death, and his wife died of exhaustion. And here's a man that's talking about helping the poor.
Well, Rousseau, of course, was a wonderful writer. Tremendously popular in his day. Voltaire was also, although he's unreadable today. I really look askance at anyone who tells me he can read Voltaire today because the style is too archaic. But Rousseau had a tremendous effect. If society is bad, if society is responsible for all inequality and all sin, and if you were to tear down society, then people in all their virtues would come forward. That was the central theory. That was the ideological argument. The practical argument was to bring down the privileges of the clergy and the nobility, which was done. And as I said, we reached to the stage of a constitutional monarchy. And it was at that stage that Franklin thought it was a wonderful accomplishment. Jefferson liked it. Thomas Paine liked it. Later on, when Thomas Paine was arrested for molesting a young child and was placed in prison and was in danger of being guillotined, he didn't think it was so good. And by that time, Franklin and Jefferson were back in the United States, and they didn't think it was so good either. Now, the only statesman who really saw where it was heading was Edmund Burke in England. And at the time that it was a constitutional accomplishment, Edmund Burke got up and said, "All I see at the end of the avenue is the gallows." Because, he said, in effect, you cannot denigrate the history of the country, the culture of the country, and expect anything but blood to appear.
Now they've found a way to attack Louis XVI. They're complaining about everything. They're destroying everything. Now comes the people, and they want to get together and start this so-called New World Order. Did they do that by starting with the General Estates? And tell me what that was about.
Well, first of all, they had the new Parliament, which, of course, they had the General Assembly, the National Assembly. They had the galleries packed. They had demonstrations almost every day out in the street. Now, don't forget, and Carlyle made a point of this in his two-volume history of the Revolution, most of the people had to get up and go to work. The people who were mounting the demonstrations didn't have to go to work. And nobody knows how they survived without working, because you needed money. And the money was getting kind of short, because once they had seized the possessions of the church, they put out what they call assignments, assignats, against the land that was formerly held by the church. And, of course, the jewels, the gold was melted down and so forth. But this was being eaten up by the leaders of the revolution. So they had paper money. And the paper money was beginning to increase in terms of volume, more and more of it. So the price of everything began to go up and up. Well, at first, not too much attention was paid to this because there was an effort to carry matters beyond the constitutional limits. The king got scared. He finally realized that he was virtually a prisoner in the Tuileries, so he had a special coach built for himself, which, of course, was no secret. He thought it was. And then he packed his family in there with a few guards, and he made a run for the border. And they let him get within sight of the border before they stopped him. And then they brought him back as a prisoner. Then matters began to get very difficult.
I want to stop you right here for just a moment. We have something in this country today called rent-a-mob. Rent-a-mob. It seems like wherever there's a demonstration, either for Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers, or for the Gay and Lesbian Task Force, or for the people in Committee of Sympathy of El Salvador, or the blacks, or this any type of a violent demonstration, we see these mobs turn out almost spontaneously, and I love that word, spontaneously.
No.
And they have all the placards printed, and they have all of the walkie-talkies and the transportation, and they stay in the finest hotels, etc. There are very, very strange people that come into these areas, this rent-a-mob. Back in France, did they have anything like that? Very odd-looking people?
Well, they had people who appeared. They had people who appeared, very rough people, too, with clubs. And they had what one observer called satanic dances, bonfires. The galleries overlooking what was going on in the General Assembly were packed. And there were great speeches back and forth. Now, you have to understand, France was a country that had never governed itself. It had always been governed by a very strong central government. And to this day, I might add, France is a police state. You have to have a special license to carry goods in your own automobile from one city to another. The police in Paris and other places are famous for jumping on your chest. The Border Patrol have got cannons. France is a very tightly controlled, run country, and in those days it was too. So for these men to engage in parliamentary debate was something entirely new. And what they did is that they roared at one another across the whole hall. And then the hall was divided. The most radical were on the left. The most conservative monarchists were on the right. The men in the middle were either way.
Is there any correlation between that and what we call the moderates and
yes.
the right wing and the
yes.
left today?
That's where it comes from. That's why they call it the left and the right and the center.
These people that were brought in to start the demonstrations, because as you mentioned, the working man has to go to work just to supply his family.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to have demonstrations, you have to have these people from outside. And you mentioned in your book that there was up to 40,000 that were brought in. What were they called? It starts with an M, and I don't want to mispronounce the word. It looks like the word Marseilles or...
Well, they could have been the Marseilles. There were a number. Now,
they distorted their faces, too, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Made themselves look weird.
And after the king was brought back as a prisoner, he was put on trial. Now, the king, the queen, and their children were held prisoners for a while. And while they were being held prisoners, of course, the terror began. The revolutionaries, the real revolutionaries, broke into the prisons, dragged the prisoners out, and killed them.
All right, now let's stop right there for a moment.
Yes.
This was July the 14th now. I want to go back to this so-called day of liberation, July 14th, 1789, which we now call Bastille Day. They supposedly went to this prison to free the prisoners. How many prisoners were there inside, and what else was in the prison besides the prisoners?
There were seven prisoners. And most of them are old-age pensioners. One was a lunatic who thought that he was Julius Caesar. And they carried him out on their shoulders, and he bowed and smiled because he thought that was only proper. The governor of the prison was persuaded to let down the great drawbridge and let the crowd in on the promise that they would simply be friends. And what they did with him, of course, was to pull him to pieces, to cut his head off, his genitals, to put his head on a pike and carry it down the street together with the rest of his body parts. And that began the beginning of the bloody demonstrations.
But wasn't there weapons inside? This is the point that I'm trying to get at. They were after the weapons.
Oh, yes, there were weapons inside. They pulled the cannon out. They were all for violence.
Now, the Swiss Guard could have protected that place. They could have stopped that thing immediately.
If they'd been told to.
If they had been told to. But King, as you mentioned a few moments ago, King Louis the 16th did not want to kill his own subjects.
He wouldn't. He never did. He never did. You're thinking about the Tuileries when they went into the King's Palace in the heart of Paris. They went into the Tuileries sometime later, and the Swiss guards then began to resist because they knew the crowd was out to kill them. Well, the crowd did kill them to the last man and ate them on a number of occasions. Roasted them that night, had dances, and ate on the body parts. And it was then that the king was taken from the Tuileries to the prison, together with the queen, together with their children. And the terror began. Now, the guillotine was done in public. The king eventually, as you know, was put on trial and was found guilty for having been the king and taken to the guillotine. So was the queen. You have to say something about people who will kill not only a man but his wife. In the meantime, there was an uprising against the revolution in what's called the Vendée, which is the farm country, where they didn't believe in all this kind of stuff. And by that time, the revolutionaries began to organize an armed forces, army. The army went there and ran down the Vendée, and the massacres and the sadistic exercises that took place then are something I don't really want to go into, but they were without limitation. Now, I remember when this book first came out 15 years ago, that one of the professors who reviewed it said that I had revived all the hoary myths of the revolution. But this year, Sidney Shamas, I think his name is, of Harvard University, has come out with a 900-page book, which covers in 900 pages the same area that I cover in 260 pages, in which he is giving you chapter and verse of all these horrors. And suddenly there's been a big switch, because we've seen what they did to the students in Tiananmen Square in China. We know what they've done in other parts of the revolutionary world. We know that the Cuban Castro has put people up against the wall. In fact, he brought the phrase into the language, up against the wall. What do they think it means? It means, I'm shooting you. So now suddenly my book, after 15 years, is in the mainstream of the latest scholarly conclusions.
You know, the thing that I drew the parallel between yours and what we've talked about over this program for the last half a dozen weeks is Confucius is saying, let 100 flowers blossom.
Yes.
Where they allow the people to come out of the woodwork, those who have thoughts that possibly don't go along with the government, and they say, please come out and express yourself. We want to make our government a better place in which to live, and we want your ideas and suggestions.
Oh, sure.
And, of course, they use that for two reasons. One, their ambassadors can immediately rush to the United States of America and state, look, we're allowing democratization. Give us money to make this democracy work even better. And the second reason they're doing it is they're taking the names and addresses. They're taking names and kicking you know what.
I'd like to know what we are getting out of this when they do. When our greatest enemy in the world is beginning to fall apart, why should we get concerned? Don't you think it would be just as well for us to say, let the bastards fall apart?
In other words, stopping all aid to and trade with any totalitarian nation.
Why should we intervene to keep an oppressive government in power?
Well, when you look at the history of the men in our State Department who have stated that they feel that it's in our best interest to keep these slave empires going, to keep a balance of power in the world, when we really know that that translates into, if I can keep a communist government alive, I'll have more slaves to produce my goods, and I can make a bigger profit. Isn't that why they do it?
Well, they may. I don't really know, but I do know that in the time of the French Revolution, once they began their atrocities, the whole civilized world went into deep shock, because it was the first time. Don't forget, the Cromwellian Revolution did, it's true, execute the king. But the king they executed was a bad king, and was known to be a bad king. They didn't have a purge, and they didn't have a terror. They didn't loot, they didn't rape, they didn't steal. The Puritan army was remarkably well behaved. There was no great massacres in England as a result of the Civil War. But when the massacres began in France, they exceeded in their horror anything that had happened to any European country since the days of the Mongol invasions. So all the countries involved then went into deep shock. England, Prussia, Russia, Austria, the United States, and Great Britain, and even Spain. So then they began to organize against the revolutionary government of France. And the revolutionary government of France moved after the king was finished. into the final stage, into a totalitarian stage.
Total government is what you're talking about.
Yes.
Which is exactly what they're trying to do in almost every despotic country in the world today.
Well, you see what was... what the revolution really had its inspiration from outside. Let me put it to you this way. A country that loses the allegiance of its intellectuals has entered a revolutionary stage. Because the role of the intellectual is to rationalize your culture, to defend it, and to explain it, and to teach it, and to maintain it. When the intellectuals turn against their culture, the people are bereft because they can't rationalize and explain these things themselves. They don't have the background, they don't have the education, they don't have the level of culture necessary. So the voices of culture then turn against the country and against the average person. France went into a desperate state, and the actual mechanics, the process of the revolution, was masterminded from inside the General Assembly. Because men don't accept orders from the street, they take orders from the offices of government. Every modern revolution from the French Revolution on has begun in the Congress. After France, for instance, it was the Duma in Russia. And in Germany, it was the Reichstag under Hitler, who produced Hitler, and everywhere else. So the General Assembly was the office of government, and the General Assembly broke itself up into committees. There were committees to run the army, there was another committee to run this and to run that, and so forth. Robespierre was head of what they called the Committee of Public Safety, and that's a very interesting name, because it really meant the secret police.
I want you to tell my listening audience one more thing before we go to a commercial break. In every one of these countries that has been taken over by a totalitarian dictatorship, and I don't want to call it communist because I don't believe that there is any communist dictatorships in the world, they're totalitarian. It seems that the intellectuals are always the ones that help the government fall. Question, what happens to the intellectuals after the dictatorship is installed?
To some extent, they switch sides. They begin to rationalize the revolution. And they get hung up in their own, hoist on their own petard. They have to rationalize the revolution once the revolution is in power. And they have a rather brief honeymoon with the leaders of the revolution.
My name is John Katz. The name of the program is One Man's View of Americanism. We're with the author, Otto Scott, who has written a book entitled Robespierre, The Voice of Virtue, which will be coming out in reprint, paperback, later on this year. It's an outstanding book, and I'll certainly keep you informed when it's ready to go to press and when it will be available. Otto, we hear about organizations in this country entitled the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergers on an international level, the Club of Rome, even Skull and Bones, which George Bush was a member of when he was at Yale University. These so-called clubs are very, very influential. Before you tell us about the clubs in France, such as the Jacobins, would you please explain the etymology of the word clubs?
Well, of course, originally we're talking about a cudgel, a bat, a club is something with which you beat people. A group of people who decide to get together in order to beat the public over the head regarding some program or another is also a club. And they operate that way. They operate in unison. And when you have a group of citizens who have privately gotten together and who then promote a particular party line, so to speak, or club line, of which the general public is unaware, the general public is unaware that it's a concerted thing, you have what is essentially an anti-democratic instrument. Because in a pure democracy, every man says out loud what he thinks and says what he alone thinks. When you have a group of people who are operating unanimously, or networking, as they call it today, then you have a network which is putting the individual in the general population at a great disadvantage, because he's up against a network, he's up against a club. Now, of course, in a free country, we allow these associations. In a totalitarian country like the Soviet Union or Nicaragua or Cuba or wherever, no kind of private organization is allowed, because you can see the trouble that the strikers are giving Gorbachev today. They've had trade unions in name only, run by the government over in the Soviet Union for the last 71 years. But this is the first time that one of them had broken out of the mold to do something on its own. In France, there was a proliferation of clubs all during the regime of Louis XIV, XV, and XVI. And they became almost, you might say, together with their press, an extra dimension of the government. Now, one of the things that emerged was the whole business of the courts of France. You know, the American people have great faith in the courts. If you have a social problem now, you take it to court, and the judges will tell you, the lawyers will tell you how to handle it. But in the whole history of the judiciary, not just our judiciary, but in every other judiciary, no courts have ever stopped a revolution. The courts have never protected the people from a revolution. In France, the courts of France, who call themselves parliaments, the courts were jealous of the monarchy because the king was over the court. So as long as there was a trend to undermine or diminish the authority of the king, the court went along. And as long as the courts went along with the attack, the campaign against the monarchy, the courts were held in high esteem by the revolution and they were highly praised. But once the General Assembly began its inquiries, and the inquiries moved into the reign of terror, you no longer had the old-fashioned courts because they said those were instruments of the old society. What we need is something new. We need people's courts. And then members of the revolution appointed committees, and they served as courts. And they, of course, seized property, condemned people to death, did whatever they chose. So you have an entirely different rule of law coming up with a revolution. You have the revolutionary law, in which all the old rules are cast to one side, and the courts who had helped bring this into being were wiped out of existence.
How important during the revolution was one club, and I know we could spend an hour talking about all the different clubs, but what about the Jacobins?
Well, the Jacobins,
why were they so? Yes.
The Jacobins were the club that Robespierre belonged to, and Robespierre and some of his close associates, Saint-Just and others, became the leading voices, the spearhead, you might say, of the revolution, the ones who were always a little bit ahead of the rest with a new solution, a new argument. And one of the things that Robespierre bore down on very heavily was virtue. Virtue. He kept talking about, what he meant by virtue was that anything that you were doing for your own advancement, to get rich, for instance, was not virtuous. Virtue was above that sort of thing. So all the rich were guilty. They had to be guilty. And everyone who differed with them was guilty. The will of the people. And nobody ever had, the people became all those who had not been in place before the revolution. So you had a whole new group moving in the name of virtue. And if you were against Robespierre and the Jacobins, you were against virtue. You were evil.
Now, they not only used that against the people and against authority, but did they also use that against the other organizations that were trying to compete with them for power?
Yes.
I think about Dutch Schultz and Lucky Luciano and Al Capone. They used to use things against each other. I mean, they were more violent and physical attack and frontal attacks. But how did these people use the virtue against the other organizations?
Well, of course, they had the Royalist Club. The Royalist Club had the best appointments and the nobility belonged to the Royalist Club, and they had very nice quarters in Paris, but they had very few people that attended.
And they supported the king.
They supported the king. Lafayette was a big figure for the in the early stage, the constitutional stage of the revolution. Then he had to run for his life, because after a while it had been who your father had been, how your circumstances as a child. You became the victim, you might say, of ancestral guilts.
Something I want to bring up is just a very minor point, but it shows how they can take one thing and use it as a catalyst. There was a baker who was hanged.
Yes.
Francois the Baker.
Yes, because he closed his shop. He wouldn't sell his bread.
Why did he close his shop?
Because the price at which it had been set would have bankrupted him. So he made the mistake of closing his shop, and somebody brought a crowd in to kill him. They tore down one of the biggest manufacturing plants in Paris because they said the individual was a royalist.
Right, but how did the Jacobins and those that were trying to take total control of the government use that as a rallying point? How do they use these minor incidents and turn it completely out of context?
Well, look what they do here. Look what's happening here. We had an industrial accident. The Valdez ran onto a reef. It was being steered at that time by, I suppose, a seaman at the helm and the third mate. The captain was down in his stateroom. They said he was drunk. Well, whether he was drunk or not, he wasn't on the bridge, so he didn't steer the ship onto the reef. Because they steered the ship onto a reef, some individuals have now said we shouldn't drill for oil off the coast of California. Well, that means that more tankers will have to come in and out of California, won't it, to bring oil from somewhere else. So this doesn't make too much sense.
I want to bring up one other thing and see if there's any correlation at all. I had Dr. Peter Beckman, who's a friend of yours, of course, and you know who he is, and he's been on the show in the past. And I asked him a question right after Chernobyl blew up. And, of course, he explained that Chernobyl was like an ox cart compared to a Cadillac limousine, which is what we have in our country today. There's no comparison whatsoever. And I said, sir, is there a possibility that Chernobyl could have blown up on purpose? And the reason I asked that question is because I noticed that immediately following that so-called nuclear accident, all of the Groons and all of the liberals in each one of the countries in Europe immediately demanded a cessation of all nuclear power plants. Is there something like that that goes on, Otto, where they can use an excuse?
Well, any excuse will do. We have, after the revolution in France, after the revolution succeeded, and of course it took a long time to come to an end, because the final stage after Robespierre, first they had the triumvirate, they had three men running the country, then the triumvirate gave way to Napoleon. And Napoleon carried them into a war that lasted for 20 years. 20 years. In the course of that war, 10 million people were killed. Whole families were wiped out. Europe was devastated from one end to the other, agriculturally, industrially, and in every sense. And France itself suffered a tremendous amount. And Napoleon spread his secret police and his system in the so-called French Empire, which was finally undone at Waterloo. All right. The revolution is over. The king was brought back. They had what they call the restoration. But the rules that the revolution had established had sunk so deep into the minds of the people that it was no question. You couldn't go back to the past. French agriculture was broken up into small plots. So French agriculture became inefficient and lagged behind other countries from then on until today. To get rich was a bad thing through manufacturing and labor because you were exploiting people, so therefore French industry, which had formerly been the biggest in the world, fell behind Great Britain, it fell behind Germany, it fell behind everybody else. The French banking system was obsolete, and it stayed that way. France sank from the leader of all Europe, all Western Europe, to a second and third rate power after the revolution. It broke the back of the country. The culture was cut in half. All the people who survived after the revolution were either descendants of the revolutionaries or descendants of people the revolution had stolen from. So France to this day fights with itself. It had a new government in 1815, another new government in 1830-odd, in 1848, in 1871, in 1946, 1945. It's had a whole series. It's never come back as the first great power. If you want to bring a country down, start a revolution.
I have to ask you one question right here, and I hope that I have this thing written down. Jeez, I just have that piece of paper right here in front of me. And I hope that I have the exact quotation written down, because I'd really like your comment on this. You cannot have a revolution in order to establish a democracy, but you must have a democracy to create a revolution.
That's a very good point. If people aren't free to argue, then there's not going to be much of a fight. The effects of the French Revolution were contrasted, as far as France is concerned, by what happened in Great Britain. All during the Napoleonic Wars, when the British were fighting France, They fought mostly on the high seas. When they finally fought on land, they landed Wellington in Portugal, and then later on they combined with the Germans and so forth to fight in Waterloo. But all during that period, British industry continued to invent and to innovate. England was the first industrial power. And as it began to build more and more goods and sell them around the world, it got more and more prosperous. It began to use textiles taken from India, and it imported and exported machinery in various places, including in the United States, because we came in on the second level of the revolution, of the Industrial Revolution. First, we found out from the English how to set up a textile business, and we did it in Massachusetts and New England, and put up a high tariff wall to keep their goods out. We built behind the shield of the British Navy. And all around the world, industrialization began to improve the living standards of the world and to increase the lifespan of people who would otherwise have died of poverty and disease early on. Medicine, all kinds of things began to flow from Great Britain and then the United States and then Germany. France lagged behind. But the one thing that France exported was the ideas of the revolution. Underneath all this material advance around the world, there was a constant whispering campaign that the rich were exploiting you, that what you need is more efforts, you've got to get rid of these people, the ancien regime and so forth, which erupted finally in Russia in 1917 and all around the globe as we see today. Now, only now, 200 years afterwards, is the intellectuals of the United States beginning to have second thoughts. But we are very far along. Everything that existed, every condition that existed in Paris in 1789 exists among us today. The loss of faith, the sexual revolution, the literary revolution, the hatred of American background and history. We were supposed to be angels. When people came to this country, we were supposed to meet them with automobiles and take care of them right off the bat. They weren't supposed to come in and struggle. We were supposed to have let the Indians have the place. Keep it!
During the French Revolution, the Illuminati came up with a set of standards that they felt was the only way to keep the people in total captivity, and here's what they had to say. The goals of the Illuminati have been summarized as follows. The obliteration of Christianity, the deification of sensuality, the repudiation of marriage and the state adoption of children, the destruction of private property, the renunciation of all religion, universal license, the wrecking of civilization by destruction of all government, and the merging of all the people of the earth under a world government. Has anything changed since that time?
No, nothing has changed. The American War of Independence created a great innovation because we set up the first government in the history of the world which did not recognize a higher power than itself. This is was the first time in which religion was never defined by the government. And in effect, religion was thrown out into the street for anybody to pick up and claim, which is giving us a lot of problems. The French went one step further. When they set up their revolutionary government, they set up a government against God. And they said so. And they began everything with the year one. They changed the calendar because our calendar, as you know, begins with the Transfiguration. And the ancient world is all the world before Christ and everything since then, the world since Christ. Well, they wanted to eliminate the whole idea of Christ or a Christ and set up the year one. They made a new calendar. They gave new names to the days of the week and the months and the years. And they used nature. They were environmentalists. They kept talking about how they loved nature and the flowers and so forth. They didn't love people, though. But they were great environmentalists. Of course, people and environments don't go together.
And if you control the population and you control the environment, you control everything, don't you?
Yes, you do.
Right. We'll be back with our guest, Mr. Otto Scott, and how they planned population control right after these messages. We're back. This is John Katz. The name of the program is One Man's View of Americanism. And my guest today is Mr. Otto Scott, who wrote an excellent book entitled Robespierre, The Voice of Virtue. It's the story of the French Revolution. It's everything that's going on today. Otto, when a nation is being taken over by a group of criminals, and I put Robespierre and Saint-Just and Danton, who one time somebody asked Danton, how can you possibly do these outrageous, terrible things that you're doing? The people are going to catch up with you and they're going to understand what you're doing. And Danton looked at the man and he smiled and he said, audacity, more audacity, always audacity.
Mirabeau.
I beg your pardon, Mirabeau said that. But what he was trying to say was, is that you'd never take one step backwards, you attack.
That's right.
Okay, now, these criminals have come to power. How have they come to power? Because they create situations like Adolf Hitler did. They rape, burn, loot, murder, pillage, burn the grain, and blame it on the government. And then they scream, they that set the fire, as you said in your book, sound the alarm.
Yes.
All right. Once these terrible things happen, there are shortages. And, of course, that's exactly what they want. All right. What do they do to compensate for these shortages?
Well, the shortages come about as a result of, first, the disruption of the government, disruption of the economy, and also inflation. Now, for a long time, I was puzzled about how any reasonable government or reasonable men could allow inflation to occur. Because inflation, of course, is a governmental crime. It means that they're stealing your money because they devalue your money and they make it worthless, little by little by little. When the people realize what the government is doing and lose faith in the government, then you have runaway inflation. Well, what happens then? In effect, you have no money. Money disappears, so you're reduced to barter. And then the only organized force in the country can have supreme power, and that's the government.
All right. Now, that leads to my next question. When you've created these shortages and there isn't enough food to go around, you have dissidents. People get a little angry, don't they?
You have also made everyone dependent upon the government.
Right. But in order to alleviate the problem, wouldn't a simple way be to eliminate or alleviate the population?
Well, that's something else. The idea that emerged in the secret enclaves of the French Revolution, in the hands of lips of people like Brebeuf and others, was that in order to govern totally and completely the whole country, you would have to reduce the number of people to manageable proportions. They discussed reducing 25 million Frenchmen to 5 million.
Well, now, that's 80% of the population.
Yes. Now, that was never actually tried until the Red Army took control of Cambodia. It's always described, by the way, as the Khmer Rouge, which is the French for Red Army. And why we use French instead of English, I don't know. If you said Red Army, the average American would understand what you're talking about. So they prefer to say Khmer Rouge. The Khmer Rouge was headed by about 20 Cambodians who went to the University of Paris and who studied at a time when Sartre was reigning in Paris. They came away absolutely drenched, dripping with all the ideas and theories of the French Revolution, and they decided to apply them in Cambodia. And that meant that they were going to eliminate every trace of the Ancien regime in Cambodia. Any Cambodian who had any European connection in any way was ripe to be exterminated. So that meant anyone with glasses, anyone with a ballpoint pen, anyone with a wristwatch, anyone with any sign whatsoever of a connection with the civilization of Europe. That was the purpose. That was the reason for the massacres in Cambodia.
Is that also the reason that they killed almost every child who had a seventh grade education or above?
Same thing. Start all over again. Kill the memory. Kill not only the past, but kill the memory of the past as well.
You know something, Otto, we sit here and we talk about this and what went on in France, and I don't even want to get into that because the horror stories of what you said went on during this bloodbath were so unbelievable that most of the people would have to turn off the radio. Now, but that happened 200 years ago, and of course that's ancient history, and we don't listen to history anymore. I mean, we have to think about the modern day. And even when you talk about the Khmer Rouge, that was 10 years ago, and after all, that's way in the past. Our kids don't care about that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have here in front of me a script of a videotape entitled No Place to Hide on International Terrorism, The Strategy and Tactics of Terrorism. And I want to tell you just one quick thing, and then we'll get back to our guests. There was a gentleman by the name of Larry Grathwald, and he became a member of the Weather Underground organization as an undercover operative for law enforcement agencies in Cincinnati. His role within the organization was to carry directives from the Central Committee to the operating units in the field. Now, during this film, they talk quite a bit about Mr. Grathwald, but we come down to the very final interview that we have with him on the videotape, and here's what he had to say. I brought up the subject of what's going to happen after we take over the government. You know, we become responsible for administrating, you know, 250 million people. And there was no answer. No one had given any thought to economics. How are you going to clothe and feed these people? The only thing that I could get was they expected that the Cubans, the North Vietnamese, the Chinese, and the Russians would want to occupy different portions of the United States. They also believed that their immediate responsibility would be to protect against what they called the counter-revolution. And they felt that this counter-revolution could best be guarded against by creating and establishing a re-education in the Southwest, where we would take all the people who needed to be re-educated into the new way of thinking and teach them how things were going to be. I asked, well, what's going to happen to those people we can't re-educate, that are die-hard capitalists? And the reply was that they'd have to be eliminated. And when I pursued this further, they estimated that they would have to eliminate 25 million people in these re-education centers. And when I say eliminate, I mean kill 25 million. I want you to imagine sitting in a room with 25 people, most of whom have graduate degrees from Columbia and other well-known educational centers, and hear them figure out the logistics for the elimination of 25 million people. And they were dead serious. Otto, that was here in the United States of America a few years ago.
Well, of course, the Russian Revolution took place in 1917. Robert Conquest, using Russian figures, statistics from the Soviet government, estimated that they killed over 50 million people who were members of the Communist Party. That's not counting those who were not. Now, some people here in the United States talk about the forced labor camps. They don't seem to realize that all the labor in the Soviet Union is forced. Everyone is working in a forced labor situation because you're assigned your job and you're assigned your salary, and that's that. There's nothing you can do about it. Unless, of course, you do what Solzhenitsyn talked about. Solzhenitsyn said at one point, he said later on, after I was in prison, I began to wonder, why did we put up with it? He said, we packed a bag and we waited. We knew they were coming. When they knocked on the door, we opened the door. We let them in. When they said, come with me, we picked up our bag and we went with them. He said, why didn't we throw them out the window? If, he said, we had waited inside the vestibule of the apartment building before the police arrived, the secret police, and if we seized them as they came in and got rid of them, how many then would come around looking for people? Well, of course, what he's saying is true. And there was a resistance in the case of the Russian Revolution, and there was a resistance in the case of the French Revolution. And it was during the resistance of the French Revolution that so many tens of thousands were murdered in the most horrible, men, women, and children. Now, there's a point here, and the point is that the Russians are not unique. The Chinese under Mao Zedong are credited by the American government with killing almost 70 million. They're not unique. The Cambodians are not unique. The Germans are not unique. All the people in the world are very similar when it comes to virtues and vice. If you encourage a massacre, you will get a massacre. This century, our century today, makes the century of the French Revolution look like child's play. More people have been murdered by their governments in this century than have been lost in both world wars.
Let me bring that up. That was my next question. We're on the exact same wavelength right now. They say between 20 and 30 million people have been killed in wars during the 20th century. And yet over 300 million people have been killed by their own governments, supposedly in the name of peace.
For their own good.
Right. There's another thing. Since I mentioned the word peace, I want to bring this up. We hear the words glasnost. We hear the words perestroika. We hear all of these detente, bridge building, etc. Now, these aren't new words, but I'd like you to tell me about something after I give you one more. The word peace. To you and I, Americans, or civilized people, let me even put it better, peace means the absence of conflict. To a communist, the word peace means the absence of resistance to communism. Do words and the way they're used help to defeat a nation or to disguise a cause?
Well, the words that Robespierre used and the words that the other leaders of the revolution used were so enchanting that I didn't dare quote them in my book, lest the reader be seduced. They promised so much. They sounded so good. And then, of course, they've had since then the complicity of our professors and our teachers and our intellectuals who have glossed over all the atrocities and who keep bringing up what they call the rights of man. The revolution issued what they call the rights of man, which they never honored, which they never recognized. But, oh, according to them, the rights of man were everything. You had everything you ever wanted to have. The only thing is you never got it.
Otto just mentioned, ladies and gentlemen, the rights of man. I had no idea he was going to do this, but I remembered something, and I had underlined it in an article that was in the New American written by Bill Jasper. And I'll be very brief with it. Senator Claiborne Pell, Democrat of Rhode Island, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, rose in the United States Senate on May the 12th, 1988, to introduce for himself and Senator Richard Lugar, Republican of Indiana, Senate Joint Resolution 317. The resolution I am introducing today urges the people of the United States to observe the bicentennial of the French Revolution and the historic events of 1789, said Pell. Quote, he continued, the more we learn about the French Revolution and the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, asserted the powerful Solon, the more we learn about our own past, end quote. Now here, 200 years later, after Robespierre, we have a United States senator talking about the rights of man, exactly what you just said.
Well, he was taught in a good American school, I'm sure. He comes from a wealthy family. And is it Delaware? I think it's Delaware. The Soviets have never done anything that has upset Senator Claiborne Pell. But the rights of man were never realized. What I remember when I was a boy in school in the United States, the teacher writing all the way across the blackboard in giant letters, liberty, equality, fraternity. But she missed, because the full slogan was, liberty, equality, fraternity, or death.
Dr. Scott, it's such a pleasure, and I have two questions to ask you. I've just gotten your book, The Other End of the Lifeboat. The Bible says that great knowledge brings great grief. If we read history as you have done, this is my first question, do you see any hope for our culture recovering before the savages take over?
Oh, absolutely. We have a very large country. We have 250 million people. We probably have the greatest number of skilled people of any culture that's ever been created. And once the majority of the people here realize that minorities are disrupting our culture, you can expect a reaction, and I'm positive that this country will not only recover, but do better than ever.
I want to interject something right here, Otto, because somebody may have misinterpreted what you just said. There are minorities that are trying to destroy the United States of America. Now, we're not talking about racial minorities here, are we?
No, okay, of course not. Ahead. I'm talking about minorities of thought, rebellious minorities, I should have said, that run across the racial border. We have a polyglot culture, and it's assumed, I hope, by all of us, that we like it that way.
And Dr. Scott, can you give us some reason, although we probably all know it, that since FDR became president and our State Department was infiltrated with those who don't like his country, how and all of the events in those years have helped the communists, have helped to destroy other nations, how in the world, and the Pope, even the Pope talks to Nelson Mandela, which just tore my heart out. How in the world are we going to be able to convince people? We have to be credible. We have to know. What would you suggest?
Well, first of all, I'm not a doctor. I have a master's degree, but that's all. Secondly, I think that there is a great residue of common sense in the people, and also there is a considerable religious revival underway. Now, I think it was Solzhenitsyn who quoted an old woman in Russia who was asked what happened, and she said, "We forgot God." And I think really that in comparison, we have problems in this country, and we have not always done the right thing. Right now, we make lots of mistakes. But in comparison to our enemies, we stand rather high, I think, and I think that we have good reason to hope.
Thank you very much, Gloria, for your questions. May I have your first name and the city you're calling from, please?
John, this is George from Atwater.
Yes, George.
I was just reading something a while back that struck a chord when Mr. Scott mentioned and defined clubs and brought the word up to date. I ran into a thing about the Fourth World Wilderness Congress. A man by the name of George Hunt of Boulder, Colorado, was being interviewed. And out of that came the World Conservation Bank, where they're going to have all of the wilderness land in the world. And then as time passes, they will end up owning the world. Does he have any information on that particular situation?
Well, that's a sort of a banker's dream. They think that by collecting debts, by collecting land in order to eradicate debts, that they'll wind up running the world. Unfortunately, you know, man proposes, God disposes. I don't really think the Brazilians are going to turn over the Amazon basin to the Bank of New York. And I don't really think that other countries are going to bankrupt themselves in order to pay off their international debts. We wouldn't. And no sovereign country that I know of will. So I think it's a great idea. It makes the bankers feel all warm inside, but I doubt that it'll ever be realized.
I certainly hope not. Thanks, Otto.
Thank you, sir, very much for the call. May I have your first name and the city you're calling from, please?
Yeah, this is Mary calling from Delhi.
Yes, Mary.
I heard something on the news that rather alarmed me. Apparently we're getting a large number of thefts from our armories.
Yes, I think that happens on occasion. And also, of course, we have a very large black market in guns of all types. We have, last I saw, we had something like 40 million guns in the United States, most of which have been legally purchased. But there's an ongoing trade in guns and arms in the United States.
Well, the thing that bothered me about that, I was in India when the independence riot started, and the first indication that we got of trouble was the raid on our armories, the run on our armories. And this is what kind of bothers me a little bit. Who is being armed by all these weapons that are disappearing?
Well, I don't know. I'm sure we'll find out in due course.
You know, the incredible thing about armaments that you're talking about, Mary, is I saw a picture the other day in a videotape, a beautiful submachine gun that was built in a penitentiary by the criminals. Mm-hmm. And they did it, and they were finally caught, but they had that thing absolutely completed, and they had it hidden in a false wall in one of the cells. But it shows that no matter where you are, they cannot stop guns, and the criminals, of course, will never stop doing it.
The funniest
story of all was when Baltimore told all their citizens to come down and turn in their guns, and they would pay them $150 a piece for them. And all the kids went out and made zip guns, and they were going in and selling them like crazy, and they bankrupted the city of Baltimore.
It's extremely easy to make a gun.
Certainly.
Anybody with a basic knowledge of how to bend things can make a gun.
Well, wasn't it the Filipinos who actually made weapons, firing weapons out of bamboo?
Yes.
During World War II?
Yeah, I lived on the India-Burma border for a while, and we had a lot of fun with those bamboo guns. And up in northern India, my family could not keep plumbing because the Afghanistans used to come down and take all the plumbing to make weapons, guns.
Well, that's one of the reasons why this country will never be well occupied.
I'm going to, after you hang up, Mary, I'm going to ask him a question that I think that you will really enjoy because you mentioned that you were in India. Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
We hear about the voice of virtue, Robespierre, and they always want to help the poor and the downtrodden.
Yes.
Would you please compare that philosophy with Mahatma Gandhi in India?
Well, I can't do that. I don't know that much about Mahatma Gandhi's actual program, but I do know what happened to the business of helping the poor in the French Revolution. The revolution was so adamant that it was going to help the poor that it made it a crime for private charity to exist. And then they set up a very elaborate system where they were going to define and statistically verify all the poverty that existed and take care of it. Unfortunately, they did not.
Now,
the poor suffered more during the revolution than ever before because the church was gone, which had taken care of the poor. You understand that most of the money that poured into the church was like a water mill. It poured out again in terms of hospitals, schools, and charity. The church really didn't keep all that money. It simply used it. Once the church was wiped out, there was no real institution left. So it was very similar to the Reformation under Henry VIII. The poor suffered more than anybody. And incidentally, the law against charity was also applied in the Soviet Union after the Bolsheviks took over. And up until Gorbachev, private charity was a criminal thing in the Soviet Union. Gorbachev has now allowed it, and there are soup kitchens in Moscow. Because, you know, the miners' strike was for food and for soap.
Incredible. G. Edward Griffin, a good friend of both of ours, has stated, "True charity is the voluntary giving of your own money. Government charity is the giving of someone else's money, and that's why it's so popular."
Yes.
My point is this. It looks like the government of the United States wants to stop charities. It has taken away our tax deductions for them. It wants to handle it all so that it can claim the credit and control people, doesn't it?
Yes, but the poor aren't going to get much. I think Tom Sowell, the black economist who is now a fellow at the Hoover Institution, put it very well when he said there'll always be a program to help black people as long as the program gives a job to white liberals.
May I have your first name and the city you're calling from, please?
Oh, John?
Yes.
Oh, I can't hardly hear you. I saw a program on A&E the other day, and it's called Danton. It's the day of the celebration of the French Revolution.
Danton, yes. Russ, go ahead.
And I recorded the program, and my recorder shut off before I saw the last part. And according to the program, Danton was sentenced to death to be guillotined.
Yes.
And I was curious, was he guillotined?
Indeed he was, and as a matter of fact, when he was going up the steps of the guillotine and he looked at Sanson, the head executioner, he said, "Be sure and show my head to the people because it is worth it." He was an egotist to the grave.
Now, was he one of the last three that was before the revolution was overthrown, supposedly, and
yes.
Napoleon picked up?
Well,
No,
he wasn't one of the last three. He was one of the last of the great competitors of Robespierre.
Mm-hmm.
And Robespierre managed to denounce him for not having enough virtue, for living too well.
It was Robespierre, Saint-Just, and what was his name, Collet? I can't remember. There were three of them at the end, and they all got their head chopped at the same time.
They all went,
right.
And Robespierre was among the last. They had broken in on him the night before. There was a rebellion against him.
But would you tell the little circumstance about the 75-year-old woman very quickly?
Well, yes. She was 75, and she was crazy. She was a lunatic. And she went around. She believed that she was the Virgin Mary. And she announced that she was made pregnant by Robespierre, and they were going to produce the new god.
Now, up till that time, Robespierre, you couldn't outwit him, and you couldn't outspeak him, but they found the chink in his armor, as you mentioned in the book.
Well, they began to spread that story all through Paris, and of course, people cracked up, because Robespierre had this tremendous dignity. And the idea that this crazy old woman had spent the night with him and was pregnant by him and was going to have a baby and so forth, it made, for the first time, it made Robespierre look ridiculous. And then, of course, he added to his own problem by having a festival for a greater higher power. And he appeared in a powder blue silk shirt with his wig powdered and all very elegant. And somehow or another, this story began to go through the crowd. He talked about the fact that you had to have a higher power. People began to laugh. Once they began to laugh, Laughter drives out fear. And that was the beginning of the end for Robespierre.
Now, the amazing thing about it, we were always told that as he was talking his way off the guillotine, or off the platform at the guillotine, that somebody from the crowd had shot him in the mouth, but he actually shot himself in the mouth.
No, he was shot. They were holding a meeting. The rebellion had begun in the General Assembly, and he fled. And he was getting together with some of his colleagues to do something about the people who were moving against him when some armed men broke in, and they tried to shoot Robespierre. They hit him, and as God would have it, in the jaw. So therefore, the famous voice was stopped.
Silenced forever.
He was silenced there. It was a very ironic thing.
Myron, anything else?
The movie, the program, followed that very same thing and showed the arrogance of Danton and Robespierre. Danton felt he could convince the committee to release him, that he could turn the whole thing around against Robespierre.
That's true. In the trial.
He tried. Then they finally came in and they wouldn't allow him to speak, and they shut everybody down. They convicted him like a kangaroo court.
Yes.
When those three men were taken to the guillotine, who took over? Was there a transitional period between Robespierre and Napoleon?
There was a triumvirate, and then after that, Napoleon.
Otto, Lenin once said that the Americans will sell us the rope with which to hang them.
Business will do that, he said.
Right, and actually, he was incorrect. We will not sell it to them. We'll give it to them on credit, and of course, we won't expect them to pay for it.
Well, we'll have a sale of rope.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's all the time we have in today's program. I want to thank my guest, Mr. Otto J. Scott, author of Robespierre, The Voice of Virtue. And I'll let you know when it's ready for publication again. Thank you very much for your participation, and we'll see you next Sunday. This has been One Man's View of Americanism. If you don't stand on your feet to say no, someday you'll be on your knees saying yes. I'm John Katz. Join me again next Sunday at 4 p.m.